I didn't even realize I was wasting $415 a month until I downloaded Rocket Money. I thought I had my finances under control until the app laid out all my spending and categorized it for me. Takeout, shopping, and unused subscriptions were quietly draining my account. And as a result, my savings took a back seat. But Rocket Money doesn't just tell you what you're wasting money on. It takes action to save you money. First, the app looks at your income and monthly expenses and calculates how much you can safely spend each day to stay under budget. Rocket Money also finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions for you and even negotiates better rates on your bills so you have more money in your pocket. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. It's time to simplify your finances and take control of your money. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Hello and welcome to F1 Explains. This is the official Formula One podcast that exists to answer your questions on the sport we all love. My name is Christian Hugill. I've presented this podcast, I'm lucky enough to say, from all over the world, and I don't take it for granted because I absolutely adore doing it. We've done it from Miami, we've done it from Texas, we've done it from Canada. I have never done it from behind a Formula One grandstand. Welcome to the British Grand Prix. We're recording this on the Saturday evening. We've had a day of all sorts of weather. When me and Katie were in Canada, we had all sorts of weather. There's something about sending me to a Grand Prix that makes the weather unbelievably unpredictable. But it's Saturday evening as you speak to us. We're behind the Copse grandstand and the weather is glorious sunshine. And with me, Katie's not here, I should say. Katie unfortunately couldn't make it over to Silverstone. She'll be back on F1 Explains very soon. But joining me for a quickfire special of F1 Explains is the former Aston Martin strategist and huge friend of F1 Explains, Bernie Collins. Bernie, it is a joy to have you here.
Thank you for having me back. Love a quickfire round.
We love a quickfire, don't we? There's a few things different about this. Bernie, it's the first time we've done a quickfire in person.
Yeah.
And I was about to say where I can see you face to face, but the sun is shining directly behind you, so regretfully...
Don't diss the sun. Love the sun here. We've not had enough of it. Don't diss the sun.
We love it, but I am struggling to see Bernie, but we're very grateful for it being here. And it's the first one we've done at the British Grand Prix as well, Bernie.
Exactly,
so,
yeah.
Isn't it lovely to be here?
It is, yeah. I love the background atmosphere.
Background atmosphere. It's just me and you, Bernie. Katie is halfway through moving across the United States this weekend. Alongside having a young baby, it's a fairly good excuse to not be here. But Katie sends her love to you, Bernie. And we miss Katie.
We will let her off.
And Bernie Collins, not only are you a former Aston Martin strategist, but you are also a best-selling author. Bernie, you've recently written a book, haven't you?
I have written a book, Christian. I have. It's called How to Win a Grand Prix. It goes through some insights into F1. It talks about how we go through the sessions. So hopefully loads of information that fans can enjoy and pick up a little bit of learning from.
What's it like writing a book, Bernie? I couldn't fathom it. Was it a good fun experience?
It was very different. Not something I expected to do. It was a guy called Morris Hamilton who's written many, many motorsport books that contacted me. And he basically interviewed me and then asked me questions about things that I thought were self-explanatory and he wanted me to explain more. So it's a bit like this, but in a book.
It's an F1 Explains quickfire special in a book. Lovely. Now, more than 100 countries listen to F1 Explains, Bernie, and I'm going to start this week's podcast with an apology. My teammate Katie Osborne is considerably better at doing the international names in the podcast, but she's not here, so I'm flying solo, and I don't know if I'm going to pronounce this name right. So I will say to this listener, if I've got it wrong, F1explains@f1.com. Not only is that the place to send your questions, it's also the place to tell me I've got your name pronounced wrong. I'm happy to have constructive criticism. It's important in Formula One, isn't it, Bernie?
It is important. I'm terrible at this as well. So I'll let you try and then I'll try and copy it.
It's always important to acknowledge where you can do better in Formula One. This is me. So I think it's Yergis in Greece. If it isn't, Yergis, I apologise and I will correct it in a future episode. Yergis says, you've talked about training for drivers and pit crews, but not for other team members. What do strategists do to train themselves and stay sharp in their abilities? Bernie?
Yeah, so there's lots of strategists can do in order to stay sharp. So one of the things you'll see on the pit wall, a lot of software where we see the cars going around on the GPS map and we see the track circle. And actually in our mission control, we can replay that. So, you know, before coming here to Silverstone, we'll replay a Silverstone from a previous year, get used to how the cars move around the track. We'll practice some of the radio comms. We can practice some of the decisions that we made and live interact with our software. So there's loads of things that we can do to stay sharp. And it helps to train younger members of the group as well by doing that sort of thing.
There must be such a lot to remember. Do you ever do brain training exercises, that sort of thing, to keep yourself sharp? Because I watched qualifying with you today, Bernie, and I thoroughly enjoyed doing so. But you were thinking about, so, you know, I've been watching F1 for more than a decade. I'm thinking about a fair bit, but the way your brain was whirring and the amount of things you were counting, you must get very good at multitasking.
Well, yeah, I think I have a really bad memory, and actually...
Really?
Yeah, a really bad memory. So a lot of what I do is, if there's something, that's why I enjoy maths. If there's something I can work out, I can figure out the answer. But if I have to remember, you know, a date or a place or whatever, I can't do it. So I need to be able to work out the answer. So I do a lot with being fit to work things out on the fly rather than remembering.
That makes sense. Fantastic. I mean, also, I would have thought sort of a good memory was key, but it's encouraging for me who has a terrible memory. I'm pleased to hear that, Bernie.
Lots of people will know what happened in Silverstone 5 years ago or whatever, but I don't. I have to go and look it up before the race. I won't remember it.
That's good to know. An excellent question, Jurgis. I hope I've got your name at least half right. Stand by for that to be corrected in future episodes, because I almost definitely haven't. Somebody who's got a much simpler name to remember is Carla. Carla says, I'm emailing from beautiful Kentucky, home of horse racing, college basketball, and Bourbon whiskey. I do like a Bourbon whiskey. I really do.
Getting you in your heart there.
Getting me in my heart. That sounds like Kentucky's the sort of place I'd like to go. Another reoccurring theme on this podcast, me wanting to visit places our listeners live. But Carla says, one thing I'm still not clear on is the DRS train. I know what it is. I just don't fully understand why drivers get caught up in it and why it's so difficult to break free of the train. This is something we quite often hear commentators like Alex Jakes say, isn't it, Bernie? So-and-so stuck in a DRS train. So, Carla knows what it is, but for anyone who might have forgot, firstly, Bernie, what is a DRS train? And secondly, how'd you get caught up in one?
So, the DRS train, basically, you will have one driver at the front who has good enough straight line speed that means the driver behind, even with DRS turn on, isn't able to overtake. So that's the formation of it. You have two cars. Then any other cars join the back of that train or group of cars, also not able to overtake because the DRS isn't powerful enough to go past the car in front with good straight line speed. So that's how the train forms. That's what the train is. Again, the reason that it's a struggle to break free is if one car cannot overtake that front car, lap on lap on lap doesn't improve that. Both cars' tyres are degradation. So unless the car in front makes a mistake, it's hard to get out of that situation, or unless one of the cars make a pit stop. So you'll often find the car in front will do a pit stop and then that will release the train, i.e. the others will be free to proceed at their speed. And the way that we use it to our advantage really is, for example, we've had a few races this year where a team like Haas has very good straight line speed, and then if they qualify well enough, they try and hold on to those positions knowing that other cars don't have the advantage to overtake. So that's really what we're trying to do. The only other thing a strategist is looking out for, if you see that group of cars and you know that people are struggling to overtake, you do not want to pit and come out behind that group of cars. So you'll do everything you can to avoid joining the back of the train, or at least joining the back of the train before you think people in the train are stopping.
And to follow up from Carla's question, Bernie, another thing we'll often hear in commentary is the strategists like yourself on the pit wall are trying to make sure driver X doesn't come out in traffic. You just alluded to it then. How do you do that as a strategist? What are you looking for?
So a lot of what we're looking for when we're trying to look at our pit window or our traffic, we know how long we're going to lose in the pit lane. It'll be something around 22, 23 seconds. So we can look on our track map or in our race data and we can see where that 23 seconds behind us is. is that behind a driver or in front of a driver? If there's a driver right on that window, we'll be looking at their lap time versus ours. If they're going quicker than us, then actually it's going to be very difficult for us not to come out in that traffic. If they're going slower than us, we can start to predict how many laps until we don't come out behind that traffic. And the reason for that is either you can come out ahead of the traffic or you can come out with a big enough tyre difference that means you should be able to overtake that traffic. So we're doing lots of calculations in the background.
The next question actually is really on a similar line, Bernie, but we're looking a little bit more from qualifying. And it's also, a lot of our F1 Explains listeners, they don't realise it, but they've got a lot in common and they ask similar questions. So this exact same question came in from Luana in Switzerland and Chad from Tennessee. They want us to explain the rules around starting a flying lap in qualifying with only a few seconds left on the clock, i.e. the fact that drivers can start their lap just before the clock hits zero. Bernie, why do they leave it so late?
Basically, the regulation says that as long as you cross the start-finish line before the checkered flag is flown, you can complete the lap on track. And that's, you know, the reason that we see them crossing so late. One of the reasons that we leave it so late is, if you imagine having a fast lap, you imagine, you know, doing a fast, you start your lap. If you start your lap really, really early, before, and you're finishing your lap before that checkered flag, that means that you risk traffic from people that are just starting their lap. So the reason that we're leaving it late is track improvement. One, the track should always be better at the end of the lap, except if it's raining or temperatures are changing dramatically. And two, because you don't get traffic from people getting ready to start their lap. So as long as you're crossing the line to finish your lap once the checkered flag is flown, then you shouldn't get so much traffic.
We mentioned earlier in the podcast that you're looking to try and make sure cars don't come out in traffic in the race. How do strategists have to make sure that cars don't get stuck in traffic during qualifying? Because that can ruin a race weekend, can't it?
Yeah, exactly. And qualifying is really difficult because you've got 20 cars on track in Q1. On a sort of average lap time, often you're looking for a 5 or 6 second gap, ideally, but it's very, very difficult to achieve that. There's basically no track that you can achieve that in Q1. So you're trying to find a gap for your driver. And if you can't find the perfect gap, you're trying to make sure that you're what we call in phase with other cars. So you don't want to be going fast and having to go past a lot of slow cars or get a lot of traffic in your lap. You want to make sure that you're all on a fast lap together, and then at least your gap to the car ahead is consistent and you don't get traffic at, you know, a high speed corner or somewhere that you don't want it.
We're here at Silverstone. It's one of the longer circuits. It's one of the bigger circuits. It's one of the wider circuits. But if you get caught in traffic during qualifying at one of the smaller tracks, Monza, for example, quite a short track, or a thin track like Miami, for example, where the walls are close, that can properly ruin a race weekend, can't it?
Yeah, exactly. So qualifying, I think actually the hardest one is Austria because it's such a quick lap time.
That's the quickest of the season.
Yeah, it's very, very difficult to get the gap there. Like you mentioned, the ones where it's a street circuit and you've got a lot of walls, so Canada, Singapore, those ones, actually the gap that you need to the car in front because of the walls is greater than at a wide track because you get much more of the aero effect of the car directly ahead of you. So there's loads of considerations, and your qualifying is so close. There's very small fractions of a second between getting the lap right and getting the lap wrong, and one bit of traffic can really make the difference to that.
It must be difficult to pick yourself up as a driver, I'm guessing, Bernie, when you've had a bad quali like that. So it's Saturday evening here at Silverstone, and for example, we've just watched Sergio Perez, bless his heart, your former driver, you know, go off into the gravel. Of course, you know, you never quite know what's going to happen in the race. But when you've had a bad quali like that via a mistake, or when you've just caught traffic wrong, you must be going to bed thinking, oh, it's going to be a difficult one. I guess as a team, you must have to G them up sometimes, think, listen, all is not lost.
It is a really difficult one, particularly because all of the run-up, you know, to qualifying here, many events, is qualifying so important. And then qualifying goes wrong. So suddenly you're trying to one driver sell, say, yeah, your qualifying position is really good, but then the other driver go, oh, we can maybe try a way around it. So you're trying to sell both sides of the coin. That's always particularly difficult. Actually, Checo was one of the best that I've known at picking himself up post a bad qualifying. But it always means that you have to redo a lot of your simulations. You know, Red Bull will not have simulated them starting in such a low position. So as a strategist point of view, you're going back to the drawing board, redoing the strategy simulations, trying to come up with a new idea, a new new plan. And the thing I always find most difficult is actually, now that qualifying's finished, people will suddenly turn to the strategist and go, okay, how do you get us out of that one? And there's no magic bullet, you know? Like, you're not the only strategist out there that's trying to win the race.
Bernie, all of them are trying, yeah, it's gone
Bernie
wrong.
Out, like, you're the least important person all weekend, and then suddenly on Saturday night, it's like, okay, your turn, okay.
So a driver's gone off into the gravel, or they've got caught in traffic, and then all of a sudden you get sheepishly someone coming to the garage, you go, Bernie, how are we going to fix this? Like a child.
What do you
want to
do? Well, we're going to do the strategy that nobody else has thought of.
Yeah, I have a magic six-stop strategy for you. Although, we should say as well, places like Silverstone, the drivers can actually, as much as they're coming to you looking for a favour, they can fix it themselves, because certain tracks like Silverstone, you think, okay, at least I can overtake, unlike certain tracks. I mean, Monaco, if you had a bad qualifying, you are in big trouble.
It is really difficult, and you do know that there's no point in just parking it at the beginning of the race. You've got to try and do your best. There's always opportunities. Even at Monaco, you know, there's always safety cars, there's changeable weather conditions, there's always opportunities. So it is about making the most of what you get on Sunday.
Sure. Let's go to Illinois now, and Catherine. Catherine says, I love your podcast. As a new fan, it helps me learn more about how F1 works. That's nice, isn't it? We like that, Bernie, don't we? Catherine says, my new love of the sport has caused me to consider an engineering career in F1. So I have some questions about that. Bernie, I'm going to split Catherine's question into two. Are you ready?
I'm ready. Sorry. I wasn't ready, but I am ready now.
Excellent, we're ready. Catherine, we're on. The first one is, how hands-on is designing/building a Formula One car, and how much is just evaluating data?
It's very different. There's a lot of different roles in the engineering office, and I think that's where, from the outside, it's very hard to understand, because we have people who purely do design, so purely do CAD. We have people who purely come up with new ideas, so we're just looking at data. And then there's many mixes in between. So depending on what your preference is, you can probably find a role that suits. We've hundreds of engineers, and they all split into slightly different areas, be it different parts of the car, you know, from aero, from wings, from mechanical. So there's a lot to choose from. And there's branches, I think, that will suit anyone.
Excellent. And Catherine adds, how many people who work in F1 with the label of engineer are actually designing/improving the car?
Well, I would like to think that everyone working under the label of engineer is trying to improve the car at least, but there's lots and lots of stuff going on. There's probably, I don't know, 300, 400 people in each team at least doing engineering. Varies team to team, of course. Most of those people are based on the factory, so we only see a very, very small fraction of those people at the track. As well as that, there's lots of other groups that we don't always think about, like the engine engineers, like Mercedes have their own engines, or Honda or whatever, not necessarily directly associated with the team. So there's lots going on, and some will be purely working on upgrades, some will be working on next year's car, lots of different aspects going on.
And I guess as well, there are engineers who are engineering the outcome of the race, as opposed to just engineering the vehicle itself.
Yeah, exactly. So there are people who are working on making the car that we currently have better, be that through setup, through the driver, through the tires we use, through the strategy we employ, whatever. There are people who are working on making this car better, and then there are people who are working on upgrades for the car, then there are people who are working on next year's car. So there's a whole host of long-term and short-term objectives. You know, at the track, most people at the track are just working on the car we currently have this weekend.
Okay, let's get another question. Ken from Ohio says, my question's regarding the length of a racetrack. Is it measured in the centre of the track all the way round, or is it measured based on the racing line where the cars actually drive to obtain a faster lap? How's it measured? Again, Ken, brilliant. Would never have thought of this. Well done, Ken.
So it is measured centre line, I believe. So it's measured centre line all the way around, and that's why often in our data, the lap distance that we have in data doesn't match the lap distances on your track map. So you'll often see in data, and actually lap to lap, depending on the line that a driver takes, you will see different lap distances come up. And it's actually difficult to manage in data to overlay laps that are slightly different distances, because they've taken slightly different lines around the lap. As well as that, if you listen very carefully, particularly to McLaren during a safety car or a VSC, on that, in that instance, we've got like a Delta that we're running to, so we're trying to run to a lap time, and they'll tell their driver safety car driving, and that means the shortest distance you can, so short line, do the shortest distance, not the racing line, because you gain a tiny bit of speed that way.
You're listening to F1 Explains, back with more in just a second.
I didn't even realize I was wasting $415 a month until I downloaded Rocket Money. I thought I had my finances under control until the app laid out all my spending and categorized it for me. Takeout, shopping, and unused subscriptions were quietly draining my account. And as a result, my savings took a back seat. But Rocket Money doesn't just tell you what you're wasting money on. It takes action to save you money. First, the app looks at your income and monthly expenses and calculates how much you can safely spend each day to stay under budget. Rocket Money also finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions for you and even negotiates better rates on your bills so you have more money in your pocket. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. It's time to simplify your finances and take control of your money. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Welcome back to F1 Explains at the British Grand Prix. As you will hear by the wonderful cars roaring round the track behind us, behind the Cops Grandstand, to be precise. It's not just me here at Silverstone. Alongside me is Bernie Collins. Bernie, welcome back.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Bernie, you're a Formula One strategist, and now we have a strategy question. Now, we've had it before, but it's a very common one. And we've got a sort of follow-up that we haven't covered. We've got new people joining us all the time on F1 Explains, so we're going to touch upon it again. And it's also always worth a reminder, because the amount of things that I get told and then forget, not just about Formula 1, just in life in general, Bernie, I'll be honest with you. But April from Toronto asks, please can you explain what an overcut and undercut are, very briefly?
As briefly as I can. So if you've got two cars side by side on track and they can't overtake, car one ahead, car two behind, the undercut will be car two stops first, and because of having fresh tyres on the outlap, then car two, when car one stops, will be ahead on track. So you're using fresh tyres on the outlap by stopping one or more laps earlier to undercut. The overcut is the opposite. So potentially the car in front will stop earlier, car number one. But car number two, because they've been behind, have better pace than the car ahead. They just couldn't show it when they were in traffic, and they're fit to push on the right lap, or the first car gets stuck in some traffic or whatever, and the car that's remained on track is able to go faster than the cars come out of the pit lane, and that is the overcut.
If I was watching a race on F1 TV, I might hear Alex Jakes, you're aware of his work, lovely man, say that the undercut or overcut is very powerful at one particular track. Bernie, what does that mean? What does the effectiveness of the undercut or overcut mean? How has it changed from sort of track to track?
So the difference all comes down to the tyres. It all comes down to how the tyres are operating at a track. So tracks that we talk about having a really big undercut, the reason for that is because the tyre has quite high tyre degradation. What we mean by that is lap on lap, the tyre gets slowly, very quickly. And that means the power of putting on a new tyre is very great. And that's what creates the undercut. That outlap is much, much quicker than an old tyre. So the new tyre lap on much quicker than an old one. That's why an undercut can be really strong. Where an overcut can be strong is the opposite to that. Either track improvement is really big, so cars can go much longer into the race. Or we see that traffic is a big issue. So a car that stops into traffic is likely to get caught in that traffic. And that means that staying out longer on your tyres is more beneficial.
Are you a Star Wars fan?
No, sorry, no. Should I be? Is that a requirement, a prerequisite to F1 Explains?
Not a prerequisite, especially not on a weekend, Bernie, where Katie's not here. If I got rid of you off the podcast, I'd be in real trouble. So no, absolutely not. It just sort of reminds me of the sort of use the force, Luke. Use the force of the overcut and undercut. The force is strong this weekend.
You've got to choose which one pretty early on, that's the thing.
Use the force, Luke. We haven't got a driver called Luke, have we? That's a shame for that particular analogy. I'll move on because I don't know where I'm going with this. I'll tell you where I'm going. To Minnesota. And to John. John, thank you for your question, all the way from Minnesota. John says, how are the corner numbers determined? Sometimes you have what looks like one continuous corner, but it's actually numbered as if it's two different corners. Who decides the corner numbers? And how are they decided? It's a great question, John. I love our listeners. The amount of time... I've been watching F1 for so long, and so many questions that they send us, I've never thought of that before. John, what a great question. Never thought of that.
So it is a really good question. And there's a few... Like, I'll come back to the examples of the circuits, but... I believe, and I'm sorry if this is incorrect, John, I believe that the corner numbers are determined by the circuit, because the corner numbers aren't specific for F1. They remain the same when there's other series racing or whatever the case may be. So corner numbers are decided by the owners, the officials of the circuit. The few sort of, you know, outlier ones is you look at Austria. Turn 2 was added a few years ago. Turn 2 used to be at the top of the straight, and now it's halfway down that second straight. We've got Hungary has a 2A, I think, a 1A or a 2A corner.
Yeah, it does.
Is very, you know, no other corner has an A in it. And there are many circuits where the numbers don't appear from the outside to make sense. I guess one of the ones that was questioned was Jeddah has, I think, 27 corners, the longest on the calendar. But when you look at that, it's very difficult to see why some of them have been numbered as corners. But I believe they're all numbered by the circuit themselves.
Do you know what amazes me as well, Bernie? Something I quite like to do when I'm at a race is run the track. Or you often see the drivers, Valtteri Bottas, for example, cycles the track every race weekend he goes to. Cycles it. And you're stood on the track, and like the track moves. Like the track... It goes in one direction. You're thinking, it's a corner.
Yeah.
That is a corner.
Yeah, I
know as a human being what a corner is. That is a corner. And then you watch it on the telly, and it's just like it's not there. And you watch the onboards, and it's like it barely goes at an angle.
Yeah,
and it amazes me what these cars can do, in the sense that even something that looks, when you stood on the ground tight, just for these amazing machines, isn't.
So, I'm not as good as you at running the track, but I did occasionally run it in the past, and the big thing for me was always the gradient. You do not see the gradient when you're on the car. You don't see any hills or dips so much, but when you're running it, by God, you feel it.
Well, the best example of that as well is Austin, because I'd watched Austin for years and had never been until last year, and we did a lovely live show in Austin. Thank you if you came to watch us. And I remember me and Katie having the conversation, saying, you don't recognise until you're there how uphill turn one is. And again, it makes such a difference. That, and also, you feel it on the PlayStation game, which as we discussed on the episode where we talk about the F1, the video game, it makes a difference to your braking, doesn't it? Because it's so uphill and you're like, oh, I don't need to brake as much. Again, you just don't pick this up. These cars just cope with it.
Yeah, it really does make a difference to braking and acceleration out of a corner, as well as that, like the corners where you're turning and there's a big change in gradient. You need to try and keep all four wheels on the track. The tip for Austin, though, is walk up the hill, run down.
Yeah, oh, great.
Just
tip.
Walk to turn one and then run the rest.
This, ladies and gentlemen, is why Bernie Collins is a strategist.
I don't run uphill. I just walk up the hill.
No, but you've
down.
Even just strategized my run in October.
It's much faster.
Okay, great. Excellent. That's my strategy. Producer Chris, write that down, please. That's what we're doing in October when we run the track. Excellent. Let's move on to New Jersey and Lennon from New Jersey. Lennon says, I'm a new Formula One fan after watching my first race this season with my husband, who's been a fan for a few years. I found your podcast after wanting to learn more about the sport, and I absolutely love it. Thank you, Lennon. We're very grateful for that. Lennon says, I've listened to every episode, and it's definitely helped me have a greater understanding of all the intricacies of Formula One. Lennon, we're very grateful. Lennon goes on to ask, I wonder if you could explain grid penalties. How are they determined? What type of penalty has a driver start in the pit lane? And if a driver qualifies P20, but has a grid penalty from the previous race, how is that addressed? Thank you so much, and I look forward to learning more about Formula One through your podcast, from Lennon. What a lovely email from Lennon.
Very good email. So lots of intricacies around penalties. So let's start with the easiest one, pit lane start. Pit lane start, I think the only reason that a driver can really get a pit lane start is if they've broken parc fermé. So they've changed something in their car between qualifying and the race. That means they're in a different car setup, basically. So they've changed it for a different part, or, you know, we see sometimes drivers doing it tactically because, you know, it was wet in qualifying and going to be dry for the race, or they had a bad qualifying, so they want to try a different setup. So that demands a pit lane start, and that is, you know, the worst penalty you can get. For all of the other drivers, including someone in P20, if they're given a grid position drop, so P20 can be given a 3 grid position drop. you know, that's fine. That they don't obviously start, they don't obviously leave a gap. What we do is we apply the penalties and we sort of come up with a rough order where that person will be 23, and then we close up the grid afterwards. So penalties are continuously applied, and that's one of the reasons why you'll see potentially someone who's starting in P20 tactically take a new engine or something that demands a grid penalty, because they can get it in when it doesn't actually change their starting position.
You might as well.
Yes, exactly. So, and you know, they carry over, like you say, from race to race, but they are just applied regardless of your starting position. It's not like if you're starting 20th, it carries over to another event or similar.
And just the final part of Lennon's question, Lennon as well asked about penalties if the driver qualifies P20. We've actually had a really recent example of that in Austria of this season. Logan Sargeant qualified P20th, unfortunately picked up a penalty during qualifying, but still he was given a 3-place grid penalty. He went from P22, drum roll please, P20. So I suppose if you're a driver, if anywhere there's a chance to take a penalty for accidentally blocking your opponent, it's when you've qualified P20.
Exactly,
anyway,
yes,
isn't
exactly.
It? Bernie, this has been a lot of fun. We've picked the best possible time to record a podcast because we've sat here. It's the first time all weekend so far I've sat here in one layer, just a T-shirt, in the sunshine. It's a lovely evening. Everyone's having a nice time. We've dried out and we've had a nice chat about Formula
Finally,
One.
My dress option has come good. Finally, I'm in the right weather.
The same with I've been on the stage a bit this weekend. And again, I've been sort of deciding what T-shirt to wear, and I didn't need to put anywhere near as much thought into it, Bernie, because it's been under 67 layers of clothing. But as soon as me and Bernie Collins decided to record an episode of F1 Explains...
Blazing sunshine.
The sun comes out. I think that says something, Bernie.
That's good, isn't it? It's really good. I like it.
I think that's the racing gods telling us something. Before we go, Bernie, if you had one more opportunity to plug your book, would you like to take it?
I'd love to take it. Everyone should buy it. The book's called How to Win a Grand Prix, and it discusses a lot of things about F1, but it goes through each of the sessions, tries to explain a little bit about what we do on the pit wall. It talks about my only win, because why not? Why not talk about that as
and
much
you'd
as
like
we
to talk about that
I like
to talk about that.
I've
well.
Got that in this podcast as well. So
every
perfect. Perfect. Every podcast I've got that in. It talks about my last race. And for anyone who likes listening to me, I know there's some of you, although not all of you.
Oh, our listeners like listening to you, Bernie Collins.
I've done the audiobook as well. Oh. So anyone wants to do the audiobook.
You've got a very relaxing voice. I very much enjoy that.
It's going to be good for a nighttime listen.
We've had
go to sleep.
We've specifically, I'm sure, I think we've read them to you on a quickfire. We've had people email in saying they like your voice. So that would be, I was about to say it's available in all good bookshops, but we're in hundreds of countries, so it probably isn't available in every bookshop.
It's not out in America yet, actually. We get a lot of American listeners. It's out later in the year. I don't understand why, but it is coming. It is coming.
But it is also available on the internet.
On the internet,
you can buy books on the internet now.
Yeah.
It's fantastic. The things they think of. Speaking of the internet, you can use that as well to send us a question, which we'll then ask an expert in the Formula One grid and record a podcast on it, which you also listen to through the internet. The internet's handy when you think about
the internet,
isn't it?
Yeah.
It's good, isn't it? F1 Explains at F1.com. If you want to use the internet or email, as we like to call it, to send us a question, you can send some words, or if she's not here, I'll say it. Katie Osborne enjoys a voice note. Give us a voice note as well, F1 Explained at F1.com. Please subscribe as well and leave us positive reviews. It helps us. And we're back with new episodes every Friday here on F1 Explains. Bernie Collins, thank you for keeping me company.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
I really appreciate it. Bernie's seen far too much of me at Silverstone this weekend, and I appreciate it.
We've seen a lot. It makes up for a lot of missed opportunities.
Makes up for missed opportunities and seeing each other through a screen on internet.
Yeah,
cool. So, yeah,
exactly. Nice. On a Zoom.
On a Zoom. Lovely to see you in person, Bernie. Myself and Katie will be back next week on F1 Explains. We've got new episodes every Friday. Send your questions to F1 Explains at F1.com, and we'll see you very soon. Bye for now.